Texas Parks and Wildlife Podcast, providing an exclusive look into efforts to conserve the wild things and wild places in Texas.
Hello, and welcome to the Texas Parks and Wildlife Podcast. I'm Lydia Saldana with Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation. Today, we have Dr. Fred Bryant on the line, who is director of the Caesar Clayburgh Wildlife Research Institute in Kingsville. Thanks for joining us today, Dr. Bryant.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, in wildlife circles in Texas and beyond, the Caesar Clayburgh Wildlife Research Institute has a sterling reputation. For those in our audience who may not know about it, what can you tell us about what the Institute does?
Well, you know, largely we are, what's interesting, we're a privately funded institute embedded in a public university. Most people see us as a private 501c3, and sometimes they refer to us as the foundation, but there's a separate foundation called the Caesar Clayburgh Foundation for Wildlife Conservation to make it more confusing. but we are a program embedded in a university at Texas A&M University, Kingsville. And we basically produce knowledge, new knowledge, hopefully, to manage and conserve wildlife across Texas and beyond even. But also, we graduate master's and doctoral students, so we're an educational program as well, and we support their degree. And we are producing, we hope, the next generation of wildlife biologists and conservationists.
Now, I did a little research in preparation for this conversation, and I knew a little bit about Caesar Clayburgh, but reading more about your institution's namesake, I mean, what a fascinating and visionary man that he was. Can you share some of that history with our listeners? Because I think it's really fascinating.
Yeah, it is so fascinating. He was born in 1873, so keep this in mind that he grew up in the early days at Cuero, Texas, where market hunting was still prevalent. People were still shooting egrets and selling them in the marketplace. So he saw that as a young child. By the time he got to Washington, D.C., his father had served in the U.S. Congress, and he became his personal secretary in the late 1890s. So along about 1896, he was in Washington, D.C. at that time, serving as a personal secretary to his father. And also along that time was Teddy Roosevelt and his partners, who created probably the greatest conservation movement our history has ever known. So he saw the market hunting. He then went to Washington, D.C. and was in those circles where they were talking about conservation. So he got a heavy dose of very poor wildlife management, if you will, and then what the new thinking was in terms of conservation. So Roosevelt and his group, you know, formed the first ever conservation organization called the Boone and Crockett Club, which I am a proud member of that organization. But so he lasted a couple of years in Washington, D.C. It just didn't fit him. And Caesar never went to school except for he went to college one year, and he told his parents that that was not the kind of life he wanted. He needed outdoor breezes and those kind of things. So His uncle had married Alice Clayburgh, the only child of Captain and Mrs. King, who stayed with King Ranch. They invited him to come to Kingsville. Well, it wasn't even Kingsville in 1900. It was just a prairie of cattle grazing with no fences almost. So he went to King Ranch in 1900 and started in 1912 to talk to the family about game conservation, and he actually established some rules for hunting on King Ranch back in the 1912. And then his ethic of conservation progressed, and he began to be known well around the state for conservation and concern for wildlife. He saw the demise of wildlife as a young child, and even as the overhunting was practiced in the early 1900s. He was invited and accepted a position as the first ever commission of what was then the Texas Game, Oyster, and Fish Commission, which is now Texas Parks and Wildlife. So in 1929, he was invited and became one of the first commissioners to serve on that, the body that we now celebrate today as the Texas Parks and Wildlife. I think he had influences that run deeper than we all know about. His cousin, which would have been Richard M. Clayburgh, who was a congressman, introduced a bill in 1931 that became what we know today as the Duck Stamp Bill, which provided funding for buying wetlands and protecting wetland habitat. So Caesar's reach, I mean, the more we read about him, he was a quiet man and stayed in the background, but the more we know about him, the more we know he had great influence across a lot of fronts in terms of conservation.
And of course, Nick, so your students, they learn about biology, but they learn about history too, it sounds
like.
Now, can you tell me a little bit more about some of the wildlife research that your students have accomplished and
sure.
how that's being applied on the landscape? I know you can't talk about it all, but maybe just a high point or two.
Yeah, there's so many things. We're 35 years old, so we're not, I mean, we're fairly young by academic standards, but at the same time, the way people manage habitat today in South Texas is a direct result of the work that we've done in our scientists and students over the last 25 years. So the current practice you see today seem commonplace, but they weren't the practices back 25 years ago. So the work that we did in learning how to manage and sculpt, if you will, brush, to keep enough on the landscape for wildlife, but also benefit cattle grazing, those kind of things. The way we census or count quail and deer today is a total 100% result of the work that was done by students and faculty at the Caesar Clayburgh Institute. So those are two, you know, really brief examples.
Okay. Now, and of course, you're talking about habitat management, and so much of that comes back to native landscaping and maybe restoring to the landscape to what it used to be. And in a previous conversation, you shared some info with me about the South Texas Native Seeds Project that I think some of our listeners will be very interested in. What is the scope of that project, and why is it important, and how does that fit into habitat and wildlife management?
Well, let me just say this: in the year 2000, you couldn't purchase native seed enough in your hand to grow it in a pot. There was no commercial availability of native seeds for any kind of restoration. If you had a pipeline coming through, or you were doing some brush work and wanted to follow up with native plant seeding, or you wanted to convert an old farm field, there were no seeds available on the commercial market. So in 2001, we said, we didn't know if we could be successful. He said, we need to figure out how to fix this. And so we began to collect seeds from all 32 counties in South Texas and evaluate them and figure out the ones that could work on a commercial basis and those that couldn't. And then we began to release these to commercial growers so that a seed, let's say pink pappus grass, is a very important native plant for wildlife in South Texas and also for cattle as far as that goes. We would understand how to grow it, how to evaluate it, and so on. And then we licensed actually a grower. And then that grower produces enough seed for the market. So in the year 2000, there wasn't enough seed to put in your hand. Today, you could plant between 30 to 40,000 acres and 30 different species that we've released to commercial growers. It's been a tremendous project. It's been very gratifying to know that no one else does this. We have the only certified native seed in Texas, and there's only one other state that has a native seed certification process. So it's been a tremendous project. The guy that leads that right now, Forrest Smith, has been asked to go tell, he's been invited to give papers in Manchester, England, and Arizona, in the Midwest, to talk about where we started, how we got to where we got to, and how other people can learn from our project.
You know, sometimes we talk about planting seeds for the future as a metaphor, but these are real seeds, right?
Exactly.
Now, where can people find out about how they could purchase, you know, if they wanted to restore habitat,
sure.
if they've got a ranch in South Texas or whatever, where do you find out more about that?
Well, there's a couple of ways. Yeah, there's a company in San Antonio, King Seed Companies, and Pogue and others sell our seed. So, and it's, keep in mind that it's been certified by the Texas Department of Agriculture. So that gives confidence to the grower. When they see the tag on, a yellow tag on the bag that says South Texas Natives, you can trace those seeds back to the origin, and you can be confident that if it says 95% will germinate, then you can feel confident that that's the work that we've done to show, to demonstrate that. You can also go to our website. You just type in South Texas Natives, and it'll pop up. And if you have a ranch in Cotulla, and you wanted to know, okay, I've got a pipeline coming through, what can I plant, what mixes of seeds in terms of grasses and flowering plants, pollinators, if you will, can I plant? You can click on Google Map on your ranch, and it'll tell you, and the soil that you're going to plant it on, and it'll tell you, give you a recommendation for seeding. Or you can just call our staff, and they can help you too. So I think our staff fields about 40 calls a week from landowners in South Texas. Been amazing, amazing project. We've also then, we've released about 30 species of native plants to commercial growers for South Texas, and TxDOT, Texas Department of Transportation, has been our biggest supporter in terms of financial grants, because they were basically the only source of seed they had were exotic plants. So they wanted natives. They came to us, and helped us financially to help get this project going. And today, TxDOT has taken all their exotic non-native plants out of their specs for road construction. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, it's a game changer. I mean, it's tremendous. And now they've asked us to do Central and West Texas. So.
Okay. And that's a perfect segue for my next question, because I know your traditional focus has been on South Texas, but I understand that you're expanding your horizon.
Well, the last 10 years, probably the first 20 years of the life of the Institute, has been focused on South Texas and then somewhat northern Mexico. We did quite a few projects in northern Mexico with black bears and deer and turkeys and ocelots, as far as that goes. So we were early on focused heavily in South Texas, a little bit in Mexico. About 10 years ago, TxDOT asked us to move into Central and West Texas for their native seed project, which we've done, and now we've been at least 5 or 6 years now working in those regions. But the other thing that's happened is that people recognize the expertise that our scientists have and the good work of our graduate students, and they ask us to actually lead projects that that they might not ask others to do. For example, we've kind of set the bar on learning how to count deer, quail, other species from helicopters, so and refine those accuracy estimates. So we were asked, for example, by Parks and Wildlife to have a look at the way they count pronghorn and mule deer, and see if we can't help refine those density estimates, because harvest or the permits for those animals is based on what you count. So we were asked by Parks and Wildlife to take on a couple of projects like that. And then we successfully competed for other projects on mule deer, pronghorn, Montezuma's quail, those kind of species. So we probably have 12 projects now that are outside of our normal Del Rio to Houston and south border, if you will.
Very cool.
So,
very
yeah.
Cool. Now, I'm going to switch gears a little bit and bring up something a lot controversial. There's been a lot of cussing and discussing in recent months about chronic wasting disease and Texas Parks and Wildlife Department's actions related to that. And I think that's probably going to be a continuing issue, certainly going into the legislative session. But what role, if any, is the Caesar Clayburgh Institute taking on this issue of CWD?
Yeah, it's a huge concern to those of us in wildlife and particularly those of us that deal with wild deer and concern for wild deer. So CWD is a scary topic for us. We have at least 4 scientists that are engaged in deer research, and they're all very concerned. A couple of things that we've done, some deer are more susceptible than other deer. In other words, a genotype could be more susceptible than another genotype. So we have a grant right now to look at those genotypes of mule deer in West Texas to try to understand which is the predominant genotype that would be more or less susceptible. So that's a direct relationship to chronic wasting disease. The other thing that we were that concerned us was, what if CWD got into populations of free-ranging deer in South Texas? The only way to project that is you have to know a lot about the reproductive biology of white-tailed deer on free-ranging herds. In other words, what do fawn crops look like in really dry years and really wet years, and what percent those fawn crops, what recruitment looks like into a population. So with all this data we've been collecting on free-ranging deer in South Texas over the last 20 years, we have the best data available, and it allows us to look at a mathematical prediction. In other words, a model, when you factor in rainfall, reproduction parameters, and then you introduce an added mortality, something that adds to the mortality, like chronic wasting disease, a new disease that comes into a population. How can we look at that out in the future and predict what that might do to a population? So we just recently had a paper peer-reviewed and published in a scientific journal that this model predicted out 25 years. And even at very moderate, if you will, transmission of chronic wasting disease, that population would be about 40% lower 25 years from now than it is today. So it is an additive mortality factor. It would reduce the A population of free-ranging wild white-tailed deer. We don't think there's any doubt of that. We based our transmission rates on work that has already been published in Wyoming and Wisconsin to get an idea of a kind of a slow-moving, if you will, death rate versus one that moves a lot faster. So a moderate death rate of chronic wasting disease would reduce a population by 40% over the next 25 years. If it moved rapidly through a population, you could knock that population down like 80 to 90% in South Texas. So this modeling effort, although it is a mathematical model, it's a very reliable, if you will, predictor of what the population will look like 25 years from now.
Those numbers are really shocking. They're shocking and scary. Now, how do you get that information, this newly published information, either to those, certainly the Parks and Wildlife Commission making policy decisions, mm-hmm. and then legislators? How do you share that info?
Well, we don't have an extension arm, if you will. The Caesar Clayburgh Institute is a research-focused body. We do put out newsletters to citizens that they don't subscribe because they don't have to pay for it, but they can get on our mailing list. So our hope is that the media picks this up, that it's a scary thing for wild white-tailed deer populations. It's something we should be very concerned about. It's not something that we'd sit around twiddling our thumbs and not worry about. Containment is obviously a concern. How do we contain it? If it does get into a wild population, how do we contain it? And some of the testing requirements are absolutely essential if you're going to manage any disease outbreak. So we have been able to provide that particular model and research publication to those in the resource community, those that have to deal with it and manage it. So if you got a better idea, let me know.
Well, hopefully some of those policymakers and legislators are listening in. Now, as if you're not busy enough, I understand that you were involved in a new organization called the Texas Foundation for Conservation. What can you tell us about this new organization and why it was formed?
Well, across the country, if you look at the pattern of across states over the last even decade, you see the threat of privatization of wildlife, fish and wildlife, not just wildlife, but fish and wildlife. That the threat is that people want to own those what we know today are wild animals, and truly the early doctrines that we live by is that fish and wildlife belong to the people. They belong to no one, but they belong to everyone. They belong to all of us. And this threat of wanting to privatize a public resource is a huge concern to the people who have formed this Texas Foundation for Conservation. So our whole goal, our whole hope over the next, 12 months at least, is to educate the public about what we call the public trust doctrine, which means wildlife, fish and wildlife belong to the people. They don't belong to individuals or companies. it's not part of our DNA in terms of the conservation community and the way we should, I think, live. There's at least three species that are of concern right now in Texas: oysters in Galveston Bay, red snapper, and white-tailed deer. There's a push out there to privatize those species for commercial or private ownership. So our goal is to, and mission in life, if you will, is to get the message out and educate people that wildlife belong to no one, they belong to everyone, and we should always, that's something we should maintain through what we know to be the North American model of conservation.
Kind of makes you wonder what Caesar Clayburgh would think about all this, doesn't it?
he'd be sick to his stomach every day knowing Caesar, or knowing, reading about him. I'm not that old to know him, but.
Well, I'm going to wrap this up today with a big congratulations to you. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation has just announced the 2017 recipients for the Texas Conservation Hall of Fame, and you're one of them. You and T.O. Clayburgh are being honored for your conservation achievements, along with Wales Madden Jr. of Amarillo and the Operation Game Thief program. And I also know you were honored recently by Texas Wildlife Association. So congratulations.
Well, it's been a humbling year so far for Fred. It's not something you wake up every day and you can't wait to go to work, and you enjoy being in the great outdoors and trying to help have an impact on wildlife conservation and management. And you never dream of those kind of things, but I'm blessed. I had God's blessed me to have a career that I enjoy doing, and hopefully done some good things and along the way. It's humbling, I'll say that. I am excited to hear my good friend Wales Madden. I've known Wales. I served on a committee with him back in the early 90s. So he is such a great gentleman.
Yes, he is.
Everyone who knows him just, immediately respects him and loves him. So
yes, yes.
And my good friend Tio, I mean, we've been friends for 50 years, so.
Well, that's awesome. And we're going to be honoring you big time at the Texas Conservation Hall of Fame Gala in Austin on April 6th. And I invite all of our listeners to check out tpwf.org to find out more info about that. So thanks for being here with us today, Dr. Bryant. We really appreciate your time. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Texas Parks and Wildlife Podcast is brought to you by Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation, supporting high-impact conservation projects across the state. Find out how you can help at tpwf.org.